Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the Guardian's guide to everything that's happening in the future this week. My name's Paul Carr and I'm standing in for Alex Krotowski while she's away doing something exciting and American. With me in the studio this week is the ever affable Charles Arthur. And live from San Francisco, we're joined by the reliably splendid Bobby Johnson. But even more exciting than either Charles or Bobby, no offence chaps, is the very, very special guest sitting across from me. She's the presenter of Yahoo's Tech Ticker Show, a BusinessWeek.com columnist, a Web 2.0 author, and an all-round tech RILF. I'm talking, of course, about Sarah Lacey, who's here to talk about the UK launch of her book on the lucky geniuses of Web 2.0. Hello to you all. So how are you finding London, Sarah?
Well, it's very rainy. And I think I've seen the best of London pubs over the last few days.
That's because I've been your tour guide.
Yes, largely.
And Bobby, you're in San Francisco. How's San Francisco treating you?
I'm still here. You're not going to get rid of me anytime soon. It's all going well. Finally starting to get into the swing of California living, I think.
Did you and Sarah do a house swap? Because she's over here, you're over there. Is it like 6 months of the year each side?
Well, I am staying in his house. I don't know if he got the if he memo.
Knows. Yeah. Do you feel a bit left out of all this traveling to strange lands, Charles?
You know, I've done a lot of strange lands in my time. I really have. I did Morocco when Richard Branson was trying to launch his balloons from there, and that was one of the strange lands I've been to.
Well, as well as Sarah, who I must admit I lured here on the false promise that I wouldn't mention South by Southwest, Charles will be talking
and
to...
And I must admit I didn't believe it, so I'm not...
Charles will be talking
15
to...
15 all.
There's still all to play for. Charles will be talking to Sky VP Stefan Olberg about what the future holds for the voiceover IP category killer. We'll also be taking a careful look at this week's important technology stories, including Sarah's boss Jerry Yang being under fire... and as always, we'll be sifting through the comments left on The Guardian's various technology-related blogs and trying to pretend we give a toss. So don't touch that dial. Sarah Lacey has been covering the technology and tech business scene in Silicon Valley for almost a decade. She's probably the highest profile and best connected reporter in the Valley. But for most of the UK listeners, she probably first came to prominence when she interviewed Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg on stage at South by Southwest. I'll be asking her about that in a second. But first, and much more importantly, Sarah's here in the UK for the launch of her new book, which is called The Stories of Facebook, YouTube and MySpace, The People, the Hype and the Deals Behind the Giants of Web 2.0. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Paul.
As if that ridiculously self-explanatory title didn't say it all, tell us what the book's about.
Well, it's about the stories and the hype and the people behind Web 2.0.
But it's nothing to do... I mean, it's about Facebook, but it's not got any YouTube or MySpace in it, has it?
And, it's got
and
a bit of YouTube.
Ascribe this to the publishers. Publishers never know what the title should be of a
book.
So
they read the preface, because actually the first sentence is about YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And there's a little bit more YouTube throughout the book. But no, when I started the book, it was in 2006. And so I had to discover, I had to figure out my best guess at who would still be relevant in 2008 and not the ones that were acquired. And MySpace had already been acquired and YouTube had just gotten acquired. So as much as they were still the companies of the day in 2006, you know, they're not now. I mean, it's companies like Facebook and, you know, in the U.S. at least Slide and LinkedIn and, you know, some of the other ones. I mean, it's the story of... who will, you know, maybe the next billion-dollar companies to come out of Silicon Valley. And once you're not that.
Why did you want it to be the ones who weren't acquired?
Because the future's still in front of them. They're still relevant companies. Once you've been acquired by someone and you're sort of inside their fold, you're really not as interesting.
Because, I mean, reading the book, one sort of gets the impression that pretty much all of Silicon Valley is populated either by venture capitalists who are sort of old and sort of a bit crusty, or else it's by very unwashed, just out of teenage guys who are bordering on Asperger's syndrome.
That's not far off the truth, is it?
Yeah, Bobby, I mean, you're out there. I mean, you're... Yeah,
I'm sitting between a crusty and a autist right now.
But the slightly Asperger-y way approach means that it seems really strange that such people, you know, someone such as Mark Zuckerberg, particularly, who comes across in this as someone who can barely have a conversation without, you know, basically not wanting to have a conversation, could have produced something which everyone thinks is the best way to get together since, you know, whatever was involved.
Well, I mean, that's what's so funny about it. I mean, it goes back to even like the days of Bill Gates and some of the, you know, very earliest guys. of the whole computer revolution. I mean, they're all socially awkward. And I think part of the magic of Silicon Valley, while you can point to the venture capital deals and you can point to all the billion-dollar companies and Stanford being there and all of that, it's the culture. And it's this cultural glue that is the reason these guys came there and the reason they'll never leave, no matter how bad the busts are. And part of it is because these guys were all outcasts that no one understood wherever they were before. And so it's a little bit of the island of misfit toys.
The thing I noticed, actually, was you do a lot about Slide, which is the company that mm-hmm. has produced some of the top widgets for Facebook. And it seems like they, for example, they had this thing which would provide a gallery on the page. And then they had this rival who are called Rocku, who had the horoscope thing. And the guys mm-hmm. at Slide said, horoscopes, who's going to be interested in that? Not realizing what everyone who reads a paper knows, which is that right. You move the horoscopes and people get absolutely outraged.
But this is the genius
ironically,
of
they
Slide.
Missed the future of horoscopes.
No, but they didn't. I mean, they quickly came up with Fortune Cookie right after that, which was, has done really well on Facebook. And overall, Slide's applications were bigger on Facebook. This is the thing in Silicon Valley. There's two different types of entrepreneurs. There's the visionary ones who sort of come up with something in the first place. And I'd put Mark Andreessen in that category. I'd put Evan Williams of Blogger and Twitter in that category. And then there's really the ones who are just executors, and that's Larry and Sergey. I mean, search was totally done before. I mean, they did not come up with anything new. They did it better. Google's actually not a very innovative company. They didn't even really come up with a business model. They just did it better. And Max is squarely in that camp of someone who doesn't come
Max,
up with the
Max
idea.
Max Levchin of Slide.
Yeah, of Slide and formerly of PayPal. I mean, he's just someone who did it better. PayPal had a load of competitors too. They were all killed by fraud. Max would stay up sort of all night and, was one of these people not showering, fighting fraudsters who were trying to take down PayPal. I mean, it's all about execution and watching metrics and obsessively trying to outdo your competitors.
One other thing that occurred to me particularly is that you have Silicon Valley, which is this place where enormous wealth is generated, mm-hmm. whether it's real wealth or it's virtual wealth, whatever it is. And yet, especially in the Web 2.0 boom, a lot of that has been built around stuff that's all been made in Europe. So mm-hmm. the fact that they could do lots of free stuff that you can basically
right,
host and run
source,
it,
yeah.
It's all open source stuff. It's Linux, which mm-hmm. comes out of Linus Torvalds. It's PHP, which is, again, I think is a European thing.
MySQL.
This is like a geek off. Can I do one?
Well, but isn't that a bit strange that Europe has developed these things that enable the wealth and then it goes off to Silicon Valley to be born?
I used to cover software for Business Week, and so I did a lot on open source, and I was sort of obsessed with this. Why do all these things? I had two questions about open source. One, why does it all come out of Europe? And two, why do they all have animal mascots? You never see that in any other software company.
Apart from O'Reilly Publishing, which is all animals.
Is it?
Yeah, every O'Reilly book has an animal on the front.
Well, see, now I can add Tim O'Reilly to the list of people I've irritated. Beyond animal mascots, I mean, why does it all come out of Europe? And I had this theory that I was thinking about doing a big story about sort of startups in Europe kind of being rebirthed. And my idea was it had sort of come out of open source and that there was such a deep understanding of, the underlying of the web and what was driving the modern web and the sense of community, which is also very important in open source and really, I think, fed into Web 2.0. Open source is, really the progenitor of Web 2.0, not just the enabler of it by making technology so much cheaper. But everyone I talked to in Europe just said, no, it just that we built it and the U.S. all made it. So, I mean, that's kind of my question for you guys. Why didn't it spawn the next wave of Web 2.0 in Europe?
Let's not forget, I mean, MySQL's been sold for an awful lot of money to Sun.
Yeah, but if you actually seen the financials, I mean, that was sort of a wacky deal.
And if you're running...
three-fourths of the web. And I mean, if you look at the proprietary software stack, I mean, database is one of the biggest layers. I mean, Oracle's the second biggest software company in the world. And with MySQL, they sell for $1 billion, which is a huge stretch based on the actual money they're making. Mm-hmm. And, it's also a statement of sort of how desperate Sun was. And if that's one of the biggest layers, sort of where does open source go from there? I actually think $1 billion for the database that runs 75% of the web, it's sort of a failure of business that it's not doing more.
I'm going to have to ask one last question. What happened? South by?
I did a keynote. That.
How did it go?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on what you read. No, I mean, honestly, it was one of these situations. An academic actually did a study of that keynote, which shocked me. And they found that there were, about 500 negative Twitters, 60% of which came from three people, and there were 8,000 people there. I mean, I think it was one of those situations where you had a very different impression of if you were there or if you weren't there, or if you were in the overflow room, or if you were in the front 20 rows or the last 20 rows. I mean, all I know is I ended up making way more money as a result and selling way more books. And I was still in Austin for the next 4 days and going to parties and out and about. And not a single person came up to me and actually said anything negative. And I even gave my email address in the keynote and said, what exactly am I doing so wrong? Here's my email. I didn't get a single negative email.
That's because people are cowards.
I got 10. But it's a low bar
to send.
You're like
the Sarah Palin of Web 2.0.
No, it's a low bar to send a negative email, though. I mean, I've never written anything for Business Week where I haven't gotten at least one negative email. That's not very hard. I did get about 10,000, or I stopped counting it to 10,000 positive emails or Facebook notes. And, you know, I think that what's great about any controversy is the people who hate you are going to hate you anyway. And it makes people who like you really like you because they all rally around and support you. So, I mean, I actually left Austin feeling very feel good about everything because everywhere I went, I was getting hugs from people. I mean, Scoble was one of the three people who did 60% of the tweets. And by the end of South by Southwest, he was borderline
80%
tears.
80% of the hugging.
And he was 80% of the
He's
hugging.
He's all hugs, that man. Bobby,
Sarah Lacey and Russell Brand.
Bobby, you're in Sarah's house. Any final questions?
I've just been looking behind the fridge. I think some stuff back there that I think needs cleaning.
I will get Mr. Lacey on that. Thank you for calling it to my attention.
And on that bombshell, you can keep up with Sarah and her adventures in Web 2.0 on her site, sarahlacey.com, which also contains her brilliant daily blog and details of when she'll be visiting a city near you. And if you haven't already ordered the stories of Facebook, YouTube and MySpace on Amazon, then frankly, you need to do that right this very second. And while you do, here's Bobby with this week's news.
Video sharing website YouTube is branching out and plans to start showing full-length Hollywood films. Reports suggest that MGM, the studio behind movie legends such as James Bond and Rocky, will be the first to post its films on the site. After just 6 months as the chief executive of UK online TV venture Project Kangaroo, former BBC director Ashley Highfield is moving to join Microsoft. Highfield, who was head of the BBC's internet and technology operations for 8 years, will take up a role running online operations for Microsoft UK. Yahoo boss Jerry Yang created a firestorm of criticism last week after a series of comments that saw him labelled poor, alone and sad. Speaking at the Web 2.0 summit in San Francisco, Yang said that he thought Microsoft should still try and buy Yahoo, and claimed there had been no poison pill approach from the company over the earlier $44 billion bid. And if you're listening to us right now on your iPod with a pacemaker, this might be a good time to stop. Researchers from the Beth Israel Medical Center in Boston have claimed that magnetic interference from MP3 player headphones could disrupt pacemakers and defibrillators if they get too close.
So, interesting stories this week. Let's talk about YouTube. So they're getting ready to start showing full-length films. Are we all going to be watching our films on YouTube from now on?
I think it'd be fascinating. I mean, you can already watch YouTube stuff on your Wii, and you can do it on your iPod Touch and your iPhone. And
can you interact with like the Wii stick? Can you
what? Can you sort of shoot James Bond out?
Yeah, like in Fight Club, just sort of punch out Brad Pitt with the Wii.
I think a lot of this is just about advertising. I mean, I did an interview with Chad at Chad Hurley at TechCrunch 50, and you know they've always been very adamant they would never do pre-roll ads, which is the most natural thing for how to monetize YouTube because it was too disruptive. If everyone's watching 2-minute clip, 2-minute clip, 2-minute clip. And so I think that one reason they've always been trying to push to longer format is to actually find a better way to monetize it. Because a 2-minute clip is very hard to monetize.
And pre-roll means an advert before the main feature, as
right.
it were.
And I mean, the other thing is that Hulu, which is the NBC and Fox joint venture that you probably can't watch in the UK.
Yeah, which you moved all the way to San Francisco just to watch.
That was extreme.
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm here. It's brilliant, and they're doing a pretty good job of sticking advertising in as well. And it's actually, you know, it's relatively subtle compared
it's
to
lots of money,
the election was. I mean, it's such a boon. I think it'll actually be interesting to see how much what Hulu's traffic does post election, because so much of the Saturday Night Live stuff and Daily Show clips, and I mean, that's where everyone was watching it.
But you can watch all of those on DailyShow.com or Saturday Night Live have a website as well. Why do people go to Hulu?
Hulu's a great UI. It's an amazing UI. They were highlighting it. You just go to it, and if you weren't quite sure, but you wanted to see something political, everything's highlighted and organized. It's a better player.
So better actually than YouTube in that respect.
Yeah. Oh, way better than Hulu is a far superior UI.
Unless you're in the UK, in which case it's just basically a message that says seriously,
just
go
away.
YouTube's desperate to make some money somewhere. I mean, it's 3 years from having spent $1.5 billion on it, I mean, you want the thing to start making some cash.
Well, and also Google, I mean, as great as Google's been, it's 98% of their revenues all come from paid search. And as a company, there's only so much more market share they can gain there. And they're absolutely desperate to find a second line of revenue. And because of sheer traffic and volume and what they paid, they're hoping YouTube's it. And so I think they're getting a fair amount of corporate pressure as well.
So speaking of desperation, let's move on to Jerry Yang, your current boss. This could be the world's first MP3 resignation letter. So he's under fire after which you can enjoy again and again on guardian.co.uk. So Jerry Yang is under fire after these comments he made at the Web 2 summit. Did anyone actually hear the comments?
I was in the room when he was giving the talk, and I was kind of astounded, really. I mean, you know, basically he was just answering the questions that John Battelle, who was interviewing him, was asking, but it was the kind of pig-headedness about it, really. You know, he was saying, we never tried not to sell ourselves to Microsoft. We'd love to be bought by Microsoft, just if they had a bit more money to spare.
You know, frankly, when you're trading at $12 a share, that's the right time to make that argument.
You know, none of it made sense, really. I mean, the guy clearly believes in Yahoo. You know, he said he'd run through walls for them. That's all great, but they need a different kind of leadership and a different kind of vision, I think, to kind of really bring things together and stop them looking like an also-ran. When actually, you know, Yahoo's still a big, viable business. You know,
it's the largest property on the internet.
Through walls for Yahoo, Sarah? If the need arose,
if
all the doors...
I think, you know, it depends on the walls.
She actually has to, because apparently, according to ValueAg, her pass doesn't work to get through doors, so...
And, you know, if I say any more about Jerry Yang, it will not work when I get back into town.
Let's move on. Thank you, everyone. And you can, of course, read all of these stories and so many more at guardian.co.uk/technology. So the internet telephony company Skype, they've only been around for 5 years, and yet it's already almost impossible to imagine life without them, especially if, like me, you travel the world and phone home quite a lot. Charles, earlier you caught up with Skype VP Stefan Ohlberg.
It was very interesting, apart from the fact that I began by calling him Stefan Edberg.
I'm glad journalists are just as professional over here as in the US.
But Skype has come a long way. But of course, what we all remember is things like eBay buying it for a nosebleed sort of price, which really got me interested in the very important question, really, for all companies that are owned by other companies, which is Skype profitable?
Yes. We are profitable, and we have been for quite some time now. We're self-sufficient, making good money.
How is it profitable then?
Well, our business model is very simple. You come onto Skype, and immediately you can use all our free services. Now, if you want to call out to phones, or if you want a phone number so people on normal phones can call you, you pay a little. And that's where we make our money.
Do you reckon that most of your money is coming from businesses using Skype who need to be doing these sorts of long-distance things, or is it coming from just one-offs, just a single consumer who's doing these sorts of things?
When we ask our customers, 30% and more tell us that they use Skype in a business setting. And among those, the business users are generally spending more. So if I were to guess, I would say that more than 40% of our revenues come from business users.
And how many users do you have in the world now?
Last time we reported, we had 338 million registered users.
And when was that?
That was the Q2 report from eBay.
And how fast is that growing?
Oh, we're taking on approximately 9 million every month.
One would imagine you're going to start running out of new people to add after a while, that the growth must be, the growth is surely slowing down now.
Yeah. We can see in some developed countries, in Europe, for example, Sweden and the UK, we're seeing the growth is slowing down.
At the same time, what sort of percentages are we seeing then?
If we were growing before at 50 and 60% year over year, maybe now we're down to 30 in our markets in terms of registered users. But we're still growing very quickly in those emerging markets because broadband, which is our underlying driver, so to say, is still growing very quickly there.
In emerging markets, I mean, that must be places like China. There was the story recently about a backdoor being discovered in Skype in China. What was going on there?
We have a partner in China, Tom.com. We had provided them source code to our application, and they had adopted that to fit the local regulations around wiretapping. I shouldn't say wiretapping, because what it was about was chat messages. We had an agreement from 2006, and this we had published on blogs, that if you download the Tom client, your chat messages will be monitored. So some forbidden words coming from a blacklist set by the state would trigger that the message wasn't delivered. This was our agreement with the local partner, Tom. What later was discovered in the beginning of October in 2008 was that not only were the messages not delivered, but they were stored on a server. And not only that, but that server had been compromised. People with special knowledge had been able to get access to some of those stored messages.
That would be the Chinese government, would it?
In the case that was reported, it was not. It was a third-party hacker, if I may say so. But what's important here is that this breach of security was only for the people that had downloaded the Tom Skype client. So only people in China.
Is that the only one that's available in China? There's no way for people in China to download the sort of the English language Skype client, or the one that's commonly available?
No, you can. Anyone, anywhere can go to Skype.com unless their local ISP prohibits traffic to that address.
And can people in China do that?
Yes.
They can.
Most people can do that, absolutely.
That's got to be quite worrying for Skype, hasn't it? I mean, it's damaging to your brand, because one of the things that you've always sold Skype on is the idea that it's encrypted at the place where you initiate the connection, and that basically what you say can't be tapped.
Just to be very clear here, that it was not voice that was tapped. And we don't have an instance where anyone has breached our encryption on voice. But of course, your point is a valid one, that anything like this potentially damages our brand, because we have said, and we still say, that we are a secure means of communication, more secure than anything else. But of course, people don't distinguish when they read the headlines between that and what has happened in China.
What about competition? I mean, you have people like Vonage in the US who are trying to move into the VoIP market. How is the market changing there? Is Vonage becoming a bigger threat, a smaller threat? How does it work to you?
We're not a phone replacement. We don't do emergency calling. We are communication over the internet. So comparing us to Vonage is not a fair competition. Comparison. They do only voice calling from your normal phone, and only a little bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. Because we do presence, I can see when you're online, even if you're sitting in Hong Kong, I see that little light is green, and I know I can call you even if it's outside of office hours. We do video, and we do the chatting, mm-hmm. and I can send you a file. We're defining a new segment of communication.
For the future, you must want to move to other platforms, to get off the PC, to be onto some of the new basic mobile devices, the things like the iPhone, the Google Android.
Yeah.
Can you put a version of Skype onto the iPhone? Can you do a Skype for the Google Android?
We've done some of our own hardware devices. We've done some mobile apps. We are making a big push in the next year on mobile, and part of it is getting on the iPhone and many other platforms. Progressing well, but having some technical issues still.
Is it about processor power, or is it about whether Apple will give you the access to the API?
It's somewhat related to Apple giving us access to what we want. Particularly, it means that we can't secure our application to the point that we would like in the current environment. But we're working with Apple and hoping to solve that.
How about Android? Is that more promising?
Can't comment on the timing there, but you should expect to see a Skype on Android, that's for sure.
That was Stefan Ohlberg from Skype talking to Charles.
Interesting that you're going to have some Skype on your mobile phones pretty soon. Your iPhone, if they can figure a way around it, Android almost certainly.
That was, I love the way he said, it's somewhat related to Apple giving us access. Somewhat related.
Somewhat related. As in completely.
Slightly. I mean, you know, that'll help, obviously. Yeah. Otherwise, we'll have to build our own iPhone.
I also found it, I was interested when he said about, he kind of not dismissed the Tom thing, but said, you know, well, the client, the Tom client was only available in China. I mean, that again, that seemed to me a bit of a double standard. I mean, China's exactly the kind of place you don't want it to be available, isn't it? It's
well, I guess. I mean, though, if people can get the proper Skype, so to speak, and if the voice Skype hasn't been hacked, then it's sort of a bit of a, it's not a complete lose.
Do you guys use Skype? I mean, Sarah, do you use? I mean,
this I is, don't.
Because I'm still not convinced. I mean,
yeah.
It's one of those things. It just seems the only person I know is my friend Anna, whose boyfriend was working in Iraq, and he used it. But it seemed like a hell of a lot of hassle. I mean, is getting onto mobiles when it's very easy to use, is that going to be the sort of tipping point, as it were, for Skype?
I think so. I mean, I've been incredibly frustrated this week. I bought a BlackBerry. I traded my Trio and bought a BlackBerry over an iPhone simply because I wanted to be able to use it internationally. And lo and behold, I bought the one model that works everywhere in the world, every tiny village except London.
This is technology reporter Sarah Lacey there. Sorry.
I mean, it's astounding the degree to which you still can't travel around the world and make calls, I mean, in this day and age. So, I mean, I think if something, that's a fundamental pain point that people have. And if it does something to solve that, then I think that's far more important than, you know, me just making calls internationally for cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, this thing, when I was traveling in the US, I kind of managed to somehow make my US mobile talk to Skype, which then made me make cheaper calls to the UK. But I had to use about four different Skype services all joined together to make that happen. It does seem like they've got a great idea, and they've got, you know, it could revolutionise everything. But
and they've also got massive penetration. I mean, if Skype was a traditional phone network, it would be the second biggest one in the world. You know, they're in many different countries. They've got kind of presence everywhere. So if they can work out how to do that properly, then, you know, there's a massive opportunity there. Finally, eBay might not worry too much about having paid billions for them.
Well, and I think if that happens, eBay will actually benefit from the financial crisis because there's so much pressure to divest Skype, and they can't now because of the markets.
We shall watch Skype intently. I don't know if you could watch Skype intently. Well, listen to Skype intently.
You almost sounded like a real journalist when you said that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at
it
you.
It almost sounded like I cared. And so, to what I have to admit is my favourite part. It's a look at The Guardian's various technology-related blogs and the insightful, entertaining, and occasionally, let's be honest, batshit commenters who live there. Charles, did anything grab your interest this week?
Well, I was looking at the post about the new Microsoft campaign, the I'm a PC campaign.
Did you do the voices for it? That's great.
It was good. They paid me well.
Thought I recognized
Not enough.
I can retire to a shed in the bottom of a garden somewhere. Creative Burp, I don't suppose any relation to Harry Hill, said, I wonder, is the Microsoft campaign aimed at making people switch back to their platforms, or is it a triage to try and stop the hemorrhaging of users to the Mac? The entire focus of the campaign so far seems to be about making those of us with PCs and Windows feel better about the fact. Oh, phew, there's billions of us all doing stuff on PCs. Seems like singing to the choir to me. It seems to focus far more on the, it's okay, you're one of the crowd, which is the wrong message. As an example, I refer to Mr. Balmer discussing iPhone adoption versus Microsoft's 60% mobile Windows market share. And for all his bluster, which has made the bigger impact?
Yeah, it's the point of aspirational market and like what brand do you want to aspire to? And my first comment when I saw those commercials, Microsoft commercials, was I don't want to be friends with any of these people. I don't want to be in the class with these people. I mean,
well,
they're
if
not
they buy
particularly.
Yahoo, you might have to. over on the PDA blog, Jemima Kish was talking about how she had to fight back the tears in the final hours of the American election, mainly while watching the huge number of powerful viral videos released in support of Barack Obama. She also talked about how amazingly well the Obama campaign used everything from YouTube to MySpace to Twitter to get their message out. The big question is, Jemima was wondering, is whether a candidate in the UK would use the same strategy. Not according to Gazunder, which is a great username, who says, you have to admire the proficiency of the campaigning, but, which he puts in capital letters to denote emphasis, Obama won this on personality. I dread to think of the second-rate imitation coming out of number 10 when they start campaigning. It already makes me cringe to see GB, well, I assume he means Gordon Brown, getting down with the kids by being on YouTube and Twitter. So he's not looking forward to the ramped up version. Gazunder, of course, is a cynic. Bobby?
Well, Gazunder's also probably seen David Cameron's
Webb Cameron.
Which just made me feel a bit sick, frankly. I wanted to give Sarah one last chance to destroy her job by going to some comments on about Jerry Yang. Somebody called P. Brian W., whatever that
stands
for.
Now, that's a username you can believe in.
Yes. He said that actually he feels a bit sorry for Jerry Yang, which is fair, I think. But he does point out that unlike a lot of people who will become unemployed during these difficult times, I'm sure Jerry would find another job, which is a fairly good point as well.
I think the point is Jerry doesn't need another job. I mean, no, he's made quite enough money.
Go that, home and
yeah.
He can always intern at SarahLacey.com.
He can. He can. I'll open up a position for him.
Here's the thing, though. They do need the job. They need the job. That's why they hang around when they should be heading off, because without the job, what is there to them anymore?
You know what, though? I always have to say when I say anything about Yahoo, I don't actually glean this from being on campus. This is my own independent reporting, and no one has given me any information. Okay, I'm not getting fired now. So I think the thing with
you
Jerry
can read the
is,
full disclaimer,
you know,
at SarahLacey.com.
He had started out being this guy who was this major player in Silicon Valley and built the world's largest web property, and it was this amazing, amazing thing. And then he wanted to sort of, you know, ride off in the sunset, which many founders do. And, you know, then when it was in trouble, they asked him to come back in and run it. I mean, he's a founder. He's not a CEO. He's said before, probably this is the only company he would have ever been CEO of. And if he's not anymore, he probably will never be CEO again. You know, he loves this company. I mean, it's dorky, but his blood runs purple and yellow. And, you know, I think he's doing his best. He probably wasn't the right guy for the job. And frankly, the board should have taken action long before it got to this point. I think the board is more to blame than anything Jerry's done. And, you know, this goes back years and years and years. So, I mean, I guess I'm with G whatever guy who said he feels a little sorry
G
for
Brian.
Him. Yeah.
G. Bry. And you can read all of these blogs and leave your own batshit comments on guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you'll also find links to our Facebook group, Twitter, Flickr, and all that good Web 2.0 stuff.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, a special look at the real reasons for the Xbox 360's high failure rate, a complex mix of problems in manufacturing, and the desire to beat Nintendo and Sony to market. As the UK government looks for a digital champion, we ask who you think it should be. Stephen Fry? Lewis Hamilton? Andy Murray? Tell us who you recommend. Eileen Gittins explains how Blurb, the Silicon Valley startup she runs, which makes high-quality print-on-demand books, is profitable. And a new campaign is demanding better funding in the UK for phone systems that deaf people can use. It's all in this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
And that is all we have time for this week. There's just time to ask, what are the next 7 days hold for you? Bobby?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you, I think. But
you told me Jerry Yang would have to kill me.
I'm gonna go and hang out with some interesting people that hopefully we might hear from next week.
Okay, Charles.
I think I'm going to be geekulating with Parallels Desktop on the Mac.
You had me at geekulating. And Sarah.
Well, I'm flying back to San Francisco, where I will, you know, I guess find Bobby in my kitchen, and hopefully still have a job at Yahoo.
Every girl's dream.
The job at Yahoo or Bobby in the kitchen?
I'll let you decide. Splendid. My very sincere thanks to Charles, Bobby, Stefan, and of course, the utterly delightful Sarah Lacey by her book, which is called Sarah?
The Stories of Facebook, YouTube, and MySpace.
At least it is in the UK.
If you're in the US, it's called Once You're Lucky, Twice You're Good.
Either, but don't buy both. They are exactly the same book.
Yes, I've noticed a lot of people on Amazon are actually buying both. Very disappointed because it is the same internal content.
Once they're lucky, twice they're quite stupid and disappointed. There is, of course, more Tech Weekly next week. But for now, on behalf of everyone here, thank you for listening and see you next Tuesday.